Hello and welcome to the July 15th, 2025 Annals of Internal Medicine podcast. I'm Dr. Christine Lane, Annals Editor-in-Chief, and I'm here with a quick summary of what's new on annals.org. There has been a lot of upheaval in the vaccine world recently, with the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services apparently ignoring established processes for vetting and approval of vaccines, firing the Center for Disease Control's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, and quickly replacing the committee with persons with unclear vaccine expertise. Hopefully, the first new article I'll highlight will inform some of the debate about the safety of childhood vaccines. The article reports a nationwide cohort study of Danish children that examined the association between cumulative aluminum exposure from early childhood vaccination and the risk for development of autoimmune, atopic or allergic, and neurodevelopmental disorders. Researchers leveraged national changes in the Danish childhood vaccination program over a 24-year period, during which vaccines with varying aluminum content were introduced. They included 1,224,176 children born in Denmark between 1997 and 2018, and used the Danish nationwide health registries to obtain information on the cumulative aluminum exposure from childhood vaccines administered to each child before age 2, and incident events of 50 different chronic disorders. Specifically, they examined the development of 36 autoimmune, 9 atopic or allergic, and 5 neurodevelopmental-related disorders. Children were followed for study outcome events until the 31st of December 2020, or until they reached age 5, died, or lost to follow-up. Cox proportional hazards regression models were used to estimate adjusted hazard ratios, representing how much the hazard changed when a child received 1 additional milligram of aluminum in their vaccines by age 2 compared to a child who received 1 milligram less. Most autoimmune disorders were relatively rare, and the researchers found a hazard ratio for autoimmune outcomes of 0.98 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.94 to 1.02 per 1 milligram increase in the cumulative aluminum exposure. The hazard ratio was 0.99 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.98 to 1.01 per atopic or allergic disorders, and 0.93 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.90 to 0.97 for neurodevelopmental disorders. For the specific disorders of autism spectrum disorder and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, the hazard ratios per 1 milligram increase in the cumulative aluminum exposure from childhood vaccination before age 2 were 0.93 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.89 to 0.97 and 0.90 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.84 to 0.96, respectively. This nationwide study did not find evidence supporting an increased risk for autoimmune, atopic or allergic, or neurodevelopmental disorders associated with early childhood exposure to aluminum-adsorbed vaccines. The European Association for the Study of Obesity, also known by the acronym ESO, released a new framework for defining obesity. The new framework incorporates anthropomorphic measures beyond body mass index and clinical comorbidities. However, the framework has not been validated. Researchers studied data from 44,030 U.S. adults aged 18 to 79 years who participated in the U.S. National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey between 1999 and 2018 to examine the risk for death of those newly diagnosed with obesity by this new framework. 3 variables related to obesity level were defined for each person: BMI alone, ESO's new framework, and the National Institutes of Health framework. The researchers found that with the new definition of obesity, 18.8% of the study population who were previously identified as overweight based on BMI alone were now newly classified as having obesity. Among those who had at least one comorbidity, 96.8% were newly classified as having obesity, 57.5% of persons newly classified as having obesity had one comorbidity, and hypertension, arthritis, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease were the most prevalent comorbidities. However, similar mortality risk was found among the persons classified as having obesity using the ESO framework compared with adults with normal weight after adjusting for sociodemographic and behavioral factors. In contrast, persons with a BMI of 30 kilograms per meter squared or greater had almost a 20% higher mortality risk. These findings suggest that further studies are needed to examine whether persons identified as having obesity using the new ESO framework would benefit from obesity treatment. And staying with the topic of obesity, a prospective cohort study found that stratifying BMI categories by BMI-specific waist circumference thresholds modestly improved mortality risk stratification in postmenopausal women, with larger waist circumference predicting greater mortality risk in women across all BMI groups. The findings support recent International Atherosclerosis Society and International Chair on Cardiometabolic Risk recommendations to include waist circumference measurement with BMI in patient screenings to identify high-risk obesity phenotypes. The next new article reports a study of the differences between trial populations and approved labeled populations in the U.S., the European Union, and Switzerland for new drugs. Researchers compared the criteria of the trial population with the approved label population for 263 new drugs approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the European Medicines Association, and Switzerland's Swissmedic between 2012 and 2023. They classified eligibility criteria into five categories: age, disease subtype, disease severity, patient fitness, and prior therapy, and compared the criteria between the trial population and label population. Drug indications were classified as congruent, meaning the label and the trial population matched, more restrictive, meaning the label population was more restrictive in at least one category, or broader, meaning that the label population was more extensive in at least one category. Among all three agencies, approved label populations were overall broader when compared to trial populations. Patient fitness was the most frequent category with broader label populations, followed by disease severity. The third most frequent category with broader label population was age in the U.S. and prior therapy in the European Union and Switzerland. Among more restrictive approved indications, disease severity was the most frequent category in the U.S., the EU, and Switzerland. The authors note that it could be helpful for both patients and physicians if regulatory agencies specify to what extent label populations are congruent with trial populations. In 2019, the state of Pennsylvania added anxiety as a qualifying condition for certification of medical cannabis. The next article examines what happened after this change. Researchers analyzed 1,730,600 individual medical cannabis certifications from Pennsylvania's Department of Health from November 2017, the start of Pennsylvania's medical cannabis program, through December 2023. 1,593,795 of those certifications were issued after anxiety disorders were added as a qualifying condition. Before anxiety was added as a qualifying condition, chronic pain and post-traumatic stress disorder comprised 67.07% and 15.84% of qualifying conditions for certifications, respectively. After anxiety was added, 60.26% of certifications were for anxiety, and shares for chronic pain and PTSD decreased to 41.47% and 10.97%, respectively. The researchers note that whether adding anxiety as a qualifying condition is beneficial or harmful depends on what alternative treatments affected patients would otherwise pursue without access to medical cannabis. The authors of the next article aim to determine the comparative effectiveness of vaporized nicotine products and nicotine replacement therapies for smoking cessation among people experiencing social disadvantage. The researchers found that vaporized nicotine products were more effective than nicotine replacement therapy for smoking cessation in a low socioeconomic status population. As this population is disproportionately affected by the harms of smoking, vaporized nicotine products may have a critical role in promoting smoking abstinence. Gastrointestinal symptoms are commonly reported by persons receiving glucagon-like peptide 1 or GLP-1 receptor agonists, but whether GLP-1 receptor agonists increase the risk of gastroesophageal reflux disease, or GERD, compared to other type 2 diabetes therapies is uncertain. Researchers use the UK Clinical Practice Research Data Link to create a target trial emulation framework that evaluated the risk for GERD and its complications in patients aged 18 years or older with type 2 diabetes initiating GLP-1 receptor agonist or SGLT2 inhibitors. The study included 24,708 new users of GLP-1 receptor agonists who had a median follow-up of 3 years, and 89,096 new users of SGLT2 inhibitors who had a median follow-up of 2.7 years. The primary outcome was diagnosis of GERD, and secondary outcomes were complications of GERD. The researchers found that during follow-up, the incidence rate for GERD was 7.9 per 1,000 persons. 138 total complications of GERD were observed. At 3-year follow-up, the risk ratio was 1.27 for GERD and 1.55 for GERD complications in GLP-1 receptor agonist users compared with SGLT2 inhibitor users. Secondary analyses found that the risk for GERD complications were higher in ever-smokers, patients with obesity, and patients with GI comorbidities. The results suggest the risk for GERD and its complications is higher among patients with type 2 diabetes using GLP-1 receptor agonists versus those using SGLT2 inhibitors. Clinicians and patients should be aware of this possible increased risk of GERD with GLP-1 receptor agonist use. A multicenter retrospective observational cohort study evaluated violent re-injury 1 year after initial violent injury among participants in the St. Louis Area Hospital-Based Violence Intervention Program. The findings did not provide informative evidence of differences of re-injury probability for participants. However, they suggest that the overwhelming risk of violent re-injury cannot be overcome by an individual-level approach. The results suggest that patient engagement in hospital-based violence prevention programs is challenging, and reducing re-injury rates may require a more sustained multidimensional approach. Also new on annals.org is a discussion of random invitation single-arm trials, a novel approach to obtain real-world evidence. And apropos, given the excessive heat in many geographic locations over recent weeks and rising temperatures globally, the topic of this month's In the Clinic article is heat-related illness. Go to annals.org for a practical update on this condition and earn CME and MOC credits when you do. That brings us to the end of this podcast. Thanks for listening, and go to annals.org for the new articles I've mentioned here. Thanks to Beth Jenkinson, Andrew Langman, and Bernie Turner for their technical support.